dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Poverty in America is growing, yet this is being focused on neither in the news media or in the actions and statements of elected officials. The creation of wealth is often part of the public dialogue, but the creation of poverty is not. Most media outlets are in business to make a profit, and those profits derive wholly from the sales of ads in the case of TV and radio, and significantly from ads in the case of newspapers and magazines. In order to command top dollar ad fees, a publication must demonstrate that it has a sizable audience among people likely to buy the products of the advertiser, people with money. Even non-commercial media, where one would expect these issues to be prioritized, are increasingly catering toward an affluent clientele, and programs on investments are far more common than programs that examine the people whose pink slips are fueling the rise of stock prices. The belief that poverty is a result of the personal failings of an individual or group has been fostered by politicians who have repeatedly framed the debate and ensuing legislation in terms of so-called personal responsibility. This theme has been echoed so relentlessly by corporate media outlets that a sizable number of Americans have been convinced that single teen mothers and alleged welfare queens are the source of the economic difficulties faced by so many hardworking Americans. What is scrupulously avoided in the coverage is the direct relationship between some people's increase in wealth and other people's fall into poverty, a relationship that exposes so-called recent economic booms as really a transfer of wealth from a large group with little money into the hands of a small, already affluent group. To explain this dynamic would shatter the myths about the economic system, and those myths are used to manipulate the electorate into accepting the situation. Tonight on the program, we'll look at some of the aspects of poverty in America. In the first hour, we'll focus on homelessness, a phenomenon caused by the uneven economic boom. In the second hour, Wizards of Money returns with a look at the growing tide of bankruptcies and the role of the credit industry in this trend.
Hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bear.
To set the stage, I'm going to read you an article published in the recent edition of The Street Sheet, a paper in San Francisco written and published by homeless people and formerly homeless people. This will be followed by a documentary on poverty that focuses on the city of San Francisco, California. Though the material in our first hour comes out of California's San Francisco Bay Area, it's exemplary of the national experience. Some of the speakers in our first hour use strong language, so those troubled by such language are advised to tune out. The title of the article is Summer of Fear. Fear of not finding a place to sleep or the next meal aren't the only fears that homeless people face daily. Homeless people in San Francisco, as throughout the U.S., must also deal with the terror of being targets of hate crimes. The national reality of hate crimes due to economic status is now just garnering increased recognition. Clearly, action must be taken to protect America's most vulnerable people, a population forced to live in the public eye. The terror reigns from South Florida to the far reaches of Anchorage, Alaska. Troll busting, random attacks on homeless people by packs of mostly Anglo male youths, is a shameful secret in communities across the country. Teenage boys in Alaska who beat and stomp on homeless people for sport recently doused a man with lighter fluid and set him on fire as he slept in a park. In July, another homeless man was set ablaze on Chicago's West Side, where the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless reports skinhead attacks on people who are forced to sleep in the city's parks by summer's shelter closings. Three Seattle teenagers savagely murdered a homeless man under the bridge where he slept, breaking five of his ribs and stabbing him 18 times in what police describe as a thrill killing. Two Florida teens stand charged with first-degree murder in Pinellas County after they murdered a 51-year-old homeless man at a bus stop with their fists and feet when he complained about the loud music coming from their car. Two Butte College football players face charges of murder by torture in Chico, California for the beating death last year of a 47-year-old homeless man who complained as one of the pair urinated on a bush he was sleeping under. As disturbing as these accounts are, what is even more ominous is that homeless people have little protection against such cruelty. Poor people are not a protected class under our civil rights statutes, and none of the hate crime measures currently being debated throughout the U.S. include or acknowledge hate crimes based on economic status. Police seem to prioritize investigations of violent crimes against homeless people only when the need can no longer be ignored. Besides, few of these crimes are actually ever reported. Homeless people are reluctant to report violent crimes for many reasons. From investigating officers' frequent attitudes of derision and suspicion toward homeless victims, to fear of the police in general. Fear of the police is certainly not unfounded. In America's urban centers, police regularly harass and cite homeless people for panhandling or sleeping in public spaces. And in recent months, police killings of homeless people have been on the rise. In June of this year, a Los Angeles police officer fatally shot a mentally ill 55-year-old homeless grandmother who brandished a screwdriver at him. This incident sparked outrage and controversy due to the extreme and clearly unnecessary measures the police officer took to protect himself. In New York City, where infamous Street Crimes Unit sells T-shirts with the slogan, "Certainly there is no hunting like the hunting of men," an off-duty officer was recently cleared of any wrongdoing after he jumped out of his car to shoot a, quote, squeegee man attempting to wash his windshield. He claimed it was self-defense. Often homeless crime victims are not given any assistance in swearing out complaints, and these reports are routinely given little priority. Arrests are made rarely, even for the most blatant violations of homeless people's civil and human rights. Experts are at a loss to explain the surge in violent attacks by the young and the strong on the destitute and vulnerable, blaming violence in the media, bad parenting, and a lack of morals. But when our law enforcement agencies flaunt their disregard for homeless people's basic safety, and the number of police murders of homeless people continue to rise, what message is getting through to America's youth? "There are negative vibes, I can see it in people's faces," said a man living in United Nations Plaza. "There is a lack of humanity in the way the public treats us." And that was Summer of Fear from the current issue of the Street Sheet, the homeless newspaper of San Francisco.
It is an early morning at the Coalition on Homelessness. Chance Martin, the editor of Street Sheet, is busy dispatching vendors of the street newspaper for homeless people. He shuffles through paperwork while bagging the next bundle of newspapers between sips of coffee. Here the realities of street life are left on the door early, as Chance resolves a conflict with the street vendor who has lost his child to Child Protective Services.
Oh. You're homeless. You shouldn't have a care in the world, bro. Yeah, I'd be stressing too. CPS has her now?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You know, if you ever want to write about this anonymously, you know, like dealing with CPS and trying to get your kid back and losing your kid because you're homeless, that would be a great story, you know, because that's an issue that homeless families are doing that nobody knows about. Nobody, you know, and CPS is like so unaccountable because CPS is formed under a federal mandate, and they're federally funded, right?
Yeah.
So they figure they got the biggest dick in town to swing around, right? And and they'll just intervene for no reason at all.
They want it. Yeah, so we're really stressing, you know. We're trying to take care of it. We'll probably have to do a program.
Oh, substance abuse program?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
In-house. But whatever it takes, you know, so we can get it back.
Yeah, well, yeah, do it.
Yeah, we see her twice a week. We see her tomorrow again.
Yeah.
Did you see the pictures?
It's a cute baby.
She'll be a year old in 9 days.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Chris.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
9 days. God is the horse's
king. So, chance.
There's a slice of reality for you.
What are you doing here?
I'm doing the street sheet distribution. Basically, we raise all the money to print and... All right, man. We raise all the money to print and produce the street sheet. And we provide it free to any homeless person that wants to vend it as a way of supplementing their income or making survival income. Or, as we like to tell the more mainstream people, it's a dignified alternative to panhandling.
These are the realities for Americans not only living through poverty, but also homelessness. Chance took us on a tour so we could see firsthand what life is like there.
So, what neighborhood is this?
We're kind of on the civic center end of the Tenderloin. This has historically been, as far as law enforcement policy goes, a containment zone for nuisance crimes, which is pretty much vice and drugs. Street level drug sales. Survival sex, gambling, you know, the kind of things that you really can't extinguish from any kind of vibrant society, but, you know, the good people get outraged about it, so you corral all the activity in the one neighborhood where the poorest people in town live. Where the most disempowered people in town live, where they have the least voice to impact public policy to make it a better place to live.
So they concentrate all the poverty in one space and contain it.
Yep.
Transforming it or trying to fix it.
Correct. And then when it gets so bad, when you have a situation like the Chronicle and an Examiner railing on a near daily basis about homelessness and poverty and the associated perception of crime in the mid-market area, then when developers come in and say, hey, we have a block, or we have a plan here to level 4 square blocks of this stuff and put up another tourist megaplex or a 20-screen IMAX theater, the people all sigh in relief and say, wow, they cleaned up that neighborhood. And then it just goes to the next place where poor people live.
So I see a lot of working types of families, immigrant families here.
A lot of immigrant families doubled and tripled up in some of these apartments around here. You know, most of the remaining SRO hotel units are centered in this neighborhood. Most of the substandard housing in San Francisco is centered in this neighborhood. That's why it's cheaper. This is it.
The Tenderloin is just one of the areas in San Francisco plagued by generations of poverty and the associated ills that come along with economic underprivilege. San Francisco's Bayview-Hunters Point is another area that has come under increasing economic devolution. I spoke with a longtime resident of Bayview and publisher of the San Francisco Bayview News, Willie Ratcliffe.
We're here in a predominantly African-American neighborhood of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
As you look out your window here, you're looking out onto the street of your neighborhood. What strikes you first about this neighborhood?
Neglect. Economic and environmental racism that running high here. A kid standing on the corner, got no jobs, and makes me think about the shipyard that's poisoning our people. We got a lot of people dying from cancer and other respiratory disease, and suffering from asthma, and plus we have the power plant over here that contributes. We have the sewer treatment plant, which handles 80% or better of all the sewer in San Francisco.
Your Coalition on Homelessness here says 40% of the homeless people in San Francisco are African American.
We'd say it's more than that. There's a lot of them they don't even know about. You know, it used to be we weren't the leading in homelessness because of people owning their houses out here. But it just got worse and worse with no jobs, see. For African Americans, the most of them wind up down around 6th Street, you know, in that area down there. But it used to not be any homeless people out here. Because people made room for their people if it was in the garage or wherever, you know, they had somewhere to sleep. We had the biggest boom this city ever had. And then the increase in homelessness of African Americans and gentrification of African Americans that pushed them out of here.
Many have written about the causes of neighborhood decline. While we may think that it is a question of morals or social deprivation, most people see it as a direct consequence of economic and civil planning by business and government officials. After the closing of the war on poverty by the Reagan administration, America's viewpoint on the poor changed from one of understanding to one of blame.
Well, the perception is that, you know, okay, deep background. The Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank under the direction of former Attorney General Ed Meese, came out with a policy paper some years ago called Broken Windows. And what it is, that was basically the genesis of what we call quality of life laws. The broken windows analogy is that if you have a part of town where there's graffiti, where there's broken windows, it's going to breed more crime. So basically, in broken windows terminology, a homeless person sitting on the corner or panhandling or sleeping on the sidewalk or urinating or defecating in public or having an open container in public is a broken window, and they especially target those types of nuisance crimes with the idea that they're going to improve the quality of life in that neighborhood. There's also a perception that widespread visible homelessness adversely affects local businesses.
Yet this viewpoint is not only local, it is international. Under the guise of corporate globalization, yet critics of globalization say that exporting jobs to cheap labor markets is a leading factor to the unraveling of the social fabric here in America. Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange.
How it impacts your life. In my recent book, I've got a whole chapter about the impact on the U.S. economy. This is for people who don't give a damn about Africa, Asia, Latin America, whatever. They say, to hell with that. I only care about here. Okay, you only care about here. Let's look at the data. What the data shows is that the average U.S. worker is making less now than they were making 25 years ago. They're working more hours now than they were 25 years ago, even though they're making less. The country's in debt up to its eyeballs, about $6 trillion. The interest on the federal debt last year was $400 billion. dollars. That's bigger than the Pentagon. And that money's going upward in the global class structure because that U.S. Treasury Department debt is owned by Japanese banks and British insurance companies, and a lot of it's leaving the country. But you're paying it out of your taxes. Now, let's go back 25 years to where it was Nixon, actually. The Nixon administration was the one that initiated these so-called free market policies. Remove barriers to U.S. companies moving their capital out of the country. Lower the tariffs, that is, taxes on products crossing borders. Notice they use a code word, they call it tariffs. The treaty underlying the WTO is called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Well, a tariff is a very specialized tax that's only paid by transnational corporations because it's when you move product across border. So they wanted to move their manufacturing out of the United States to places where they could pay workers a dollar a day. Because obviously you can make bigger profits if you're producing your stuff with workers getting paid a dollar a day, no trade unions like in China, destroy the environment, weaker environmental controls, etc. But you got a problem. If you go outside the U.S. and produce that, and then you're going to pay high taxes when you bring it back in the United States, that kind of undercuts the whole point of it. So they lobbied both internationally and within the U.S. Congress, and they got a lowering of the tax rate. And I have those charts in my book, too, showing how the tax rate on the corporations has plummeted. The tax rate on us individuals has gone up, but the tax rate on these biggest corporations has gone down. That made it easier for them to move the manufacturing base out of the United States. So when I was a kid coming out of high school, right, in the late 1960s, you could get good-paying jobs that you could actually support a family on one paycheck. That doesn't exist anymore because those good manufacturing jobs left the country. And I'll give you just one statistic that shows how severe this is. The United States, as a nation, imports more computer equipment and electronics from China than China buys from the United States. Now, on the surface, you say, no, wait, that couldn't be right. No, it's right. But it's not about China. It's Dell, Compaq, Macintosh, Intel, Hewlett-Packard. They move their factories from the United States to places like China. Of course, they want to sell the stuff back here because we still have money, right, to pay for it, whereas in a lot of those third world countries, workers don't. So talk about patriotism. The leaders of this country are the most unpatriotic. They're more unpatriotic than any kid out burning a flag in the street. That's symbolic. These guys actually gutted the country's economy, got the country into debt. The U.S. federal government debt is over three times the size of all third world debt combined. So where does the United States come off telling these third world countries, hey, you're in debt, you're running your country bad, you got to do what we say? People aren't idiots. They see this outside the United States. They say, you give hypocrisy a bad name. You know, this is crazy. We're not going to listen to you. So there's a legitimacy crisis as well. And that's one of the reasons why people resent us. But even if you don't care about that, just in terms of our standard of living here, it's declining. Because of the way these guys are running the country, they don't care about the United States. They care about their bank accounts and their global investors. So they'll gut the entire U.S. economy.
The issue of displacement and poverty are deeply intertwined. In San Francisco, one of the major issues during the economic boom of the dot-com phase was the issue of gentrification. Willie Ratcliffe has seen the same gentrification issue affect his community.
They ran everybody out of there. You know, 200 businesses, 5,000 homes got destroyed. And then the redevelopment agents admitted that their policy was to remove black people out of San Francisco. They were getting a little too powerful, too many of them, you know, and they're too clannish.
Either they want to just bypass this neighborhood and not really make it?
No, the big developers want it. They want the neighborhood. This is still San Francisco, and actually it's the most... It's the best part of it. Earthquake. We have no problem with the earthquake. We're living on rocks out here. You know, you can get right on 3rd Street and look downtown. You know, so that's what's happening is the big developers want it. Some of the largest developers in the country wants to grab up this land and develop. They want to develop 3rd Street and run us off of here. We own 3rd Street now. We own the land. We ain't just here renting. You know, these buildings are owned by black people. Just like the largest percentage of home ownership in this city is out here. And that's because of ownership by black people. See, that's the only thing they let them own. And damn it, they went and done that. Out of the little money they was making at the shipyard, all of them went and bought houses when they were cheap out here. Most of them are paid for. So people got a lot of equity. You know, there's nothing to find. People in that little old bank down the corner got $200,000-$300,000 in there. Plus the house paid for. So we got a lot of wealth out here, but it's not being used.
The problem is not just a matter of redevelopment agencies, realtors, and greedy landlords. It extends even to public policy, as Chance Martin explains how housing projects are slowly gentrified.
So we have people that make $40,000 a year eligible for public housing. What it works out to is the people that are displaced, only about a third of them are eligible to move back in to the new project that replaced the old project. And that's why we have a disproportionate amount of African Americans in our homeless population. African Americans in San Francisco, demographically, we're losing our African American population. I think from the 90 census to the 2000 census, we lost about 2% of our African American population. Meanwhile, if you look at our homeless population demographically, 40% of them are African American. So, you know, there is an inherent racism in these kinds of federal policies.
The repetitive theme of capitalizing at people's expense by corporations is repeated not only in traditional business sectors, but is now being exported to public services, such as the prison system. The latest sector to come under capital control is the homeless industrial complex. Chance Martin explains this phenomenon.
Make some killer profits off this started showing up. As soon as the Fed started funding homeless services, that was like the signal that the gravy train is on. And people that were politically connected, people who saw the opportunity to rake in big contracts started popping up. Some are provided by private contractors. The majority are provided by private contractors. It's always an advantageous thing for people who are out to make a profit to have a readily available source of casual labor. But, you know, I tend to look at homelessness in San Francisco, you know, the reason why we don't build more affordable housing and get these people off the streets, you know, is because there's a lot of corruption there. There's a lot of shelter managers and program managers making exorbitant salaries. There's a lot of contracts, you know, short-end contracts that are awarded on a buddy system. None of this, you know, all of this makes it more expensive to provide these services, and none of them provide the first enhancement to the services that we're offering to homeless people. So then, you know, the homeless situation naturally in that climate becomes exacerbated, and the business owners yell, you know, the Chronicle can't tell the truth about the corruption in this mayoral administration, so who do they blame? The victim. It's very neat. It's very fascist.
Chance explains how the government will give money to one nonprofit organization with exorbitant salaries, and that money will be funneled back into political dirty tricks.
In the case of Walden House, which is undeniably the largest provider of substance abuse treatment services in San Francisco, I pulled their 1999 IRS 990 up and found out that Alfonso Alcamporo, who is the executive director there, in addition to about $100,000 annual salary and an expense account of about $10,000 to $15,000, also paid another $100,000 in 1 year into his retirement account. Not surprisingly, Alfonso Alcamporo is very connected with the mayor, is very connected with the courts, is awarded city contract after city contract There was some speculation that there might have been some malfeasance in a recent election that we had, where one of the initiatives in that election was the stadium bond vote. There was allegations of ballot box stuffing, and it seemed very eerie because every questionable circumstance when it came to ballots involved somebody from Walden House who was a volunteer. Nothing was ever proved. The story was dropped out of the press like a hot rock, and later that year Mayor Willie Brown gave Walden House $3 million in discretionary funds.
With so much corruption and money and public interest at stake, one would think that the media would be critical of this industrialization of public services and human resources. The Chronicle newspaper is the main source of public criticism for the San Francisco community. But the Chronicle is also a corporation. It should be noted that the Chronicle owns over 22 buildings within the district of the Tenderloin. Chance Martin explains the Chronicle and its impact on local thought on homelessness.
The Chronicle has a building down on 6th Street.
Yeah.
What is the relationship to the Chronicle's inability to portray homeless people in a fair and decent light, and to their ownership of a building in a poor neighborhood that they want to redevelop?
Well, I think it's disingenuous to approach the Chronicle as the Chronicle. All right, we're talking about the Hearst Corporation, and the Hearst Corporation has vast media holdings. You know, magazines, television stations, newspapers, and I think the Chronicle is carrying on the fine Hearst tradition, you know, of yellow journalism, you know, except instead of targeting, you know, in the case of yellow journalism, a minority, which was our Chinese immigrants, you know, we're targeting people who are economically disadvantaged, and by virtue of that, have to conduct their lives in a different manner than the rest of society. The Hearst Corporation is very influential. There's a lot of stuff that came out in the Examiner trial that basically said that Tim White, you know, at the Examiner, and then the Chronicle as they acquired it, that they cut a deal with Mayor Willie Brown that he would help facilitate the acquisition of the Chronicle and the sale of the Examiner to the Fang family, for the Chronicle laying off charges of corruption in the Brown administration. All of a sudden, there's an absence of any reporting on corruption in the Brown administration. And when you...
Chance Martin is not alone in his skepticism of the Chronicle's ability to report the facts accurately and objectively. Willie Ratcliffe expresses a similar doubt in the following.
Why doesn't the rest of San Francisco ever hear about what's going on in these neighborhoods? Is the Chronicle just ignorant, or are they purposely ignoring the issues?
Purposely ignoring. The Chronicle, like the Chronicle, is part of the problem. They are one of the big corporations that throws their weight around. We want to move whatever roadblocks is in our way. And we're not particularly about who it is or what color they are or any of the other things. We want some justice for our community to be stopped being discriminated against, stop being profiled, stop being thrown in prison because lack of jobs. Our biggest problem is economic and environmental racism practiced by government and private industry. All government and private industry.
Racism, homelessness, intertwined in the capitalist system. In the preceding, you have been listening to some of the voices of ordinary people doing what they can to make life better for their neighbors.
That was part one of a documentary series, Poverty in America, produced by the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. Earlier this month, the Right to Sleep Summit was held in the small coastal city of Santa Cruz, California. The summit grew out of activism in opposition to the city's camping ban. a quality of life ordinance of the type discussed in the previous documentary that serves to criminalize survival options for homeless residents. Terry Messman is the editor of another Northern California homeless newspaper, Street Spirit, as well as an activist on homeless issues. He spoke at the summit of techniques that have had a positive result in the face of government apathy and hostility.
In Oakland, every time we took over a building, we sledgehammered the door open with the TV cameras rolling because we wanted to show the city that we were serious. Yeah. We wanted to show the cops we were serious. We wanted to show them we were taking this fucking house, reclaiming it in the name of homeless people. And the minute we got inside, we barricaded ourselves inside and would hold those houses up to 11 days. Some of them we won permanently, and we built lots of permanent housing that way. So when I wrap up with some solutions, I want to talk about housing takeovers, not just encampments, but about taking the property of this corrupt economic system and giving it to the people that deserve it. It's like Robin Hood, right? So, but I want to start by saying that we need to look at where we are. I know we have visitors from Dignity Village, and I'm very glad you're here from Oregon. And sometimes Oregon looks like utopia to me. I know it's probably not, but I say utopia because we're in California with some of the most liberal cities in this nation, and homeless people are victims of an increasing level of discrimination and civil rights abuses that should blow all of our minds. I mean, I know we're dealing with this in our local communities, but let's just take a minute to look at the most liberal cities in America. In Oakland, one of the most liberal cities with liberal Mayor Jerry Brown, homeless people are being ruthlessly driven out of downtown by unjust evictions, soaring rents, and a NIMBYism attitude that wants to exile homeless services out of downtown Oakland. It's sickening. In Santa Monica, again, a city known across the country as being liberal, an affluent tourist city, Street Spirit has articles about David Bush's fight to be treated as a human being. People are discriminated against in Santa Monica, and they created one of the most, one of the models of how to ban camping in that affluent community. And to show you how these things spread like a bad virus, Santa Monica launched a camping ban a few years back. Richmond, California, a progressive working class city, one of the most liberal cities, just on December 11th, copied the Santa Monica camping ban and instituted what I think is the worst law in the state of California. This is what the Richmond law said. It was passed by a 7-1 majority of their city council, and this is what it says. Homeless people, you are now a criminal as of December 11th. It is a criminal act for you to sleep outdoors anywhere in city limits, private, public, city-owned, doesn't matter. You're a criminal. You sleep in a vehicle, you're a criminal. If you possess a tent, a blanket, or a sleeping bag, you are a criminal. If you get tired and sit a blanket down on a sidewalk, you're a criminal. That's what Richmond, California has done to homeless people. There's a question we should ask ourselves. This is a liberal city doing something that the most reactionary cities of the Deep South did to black Americans during the dark days of Jim Crow segregation. So in Richmond, it's basically a minority-dominated city. African-American people, Latino people that are homeless, are being told by their city council that they are criminals anywhere in the city limits. Let's look at that for a minute. If any other minority in this country is told it has their being criminalized by a city council, we're going to see lawsuits, massive protests, and the city of Richmond would be an international pariah. And what I would say is that it's our job as homeless movement folks to make the city of Richmond an international pariah for saying to one minority that you have to leave town or you're a criminal. Now, look at who has done this. It's a liberal city council, and yet if you look closely at their camping ban, and I'm sorry we don't have Street Spirit here, I've done a page 2 article analyzing their camping ban. If you look at that, something becomes really obvious. And we as activists shouldn't use exaggeration, so let me assure you this is not exaggeration. The Richmond camping ban has institutionalized the politics of the Ku Klux Klan in Richmond, California. You know, the Klan burned the cross on somebody's door to drive them out of the community. The Richmond City Council put a camping ban to drive somebody out of the community. It's the same thing we're dealing with, and that's not an exaggeration. So I could go down the list, but in Santa Cruz, people are criminalized left, right, and center if they're homeless. Santa Cruz is a liberal to progressive city. San Francisco, Berkeley, the same dynamic. Liberal cities persecuting homeless people. So somehow, even in our most liberal cities, it is safe to attack the homeless. And here we are. This is us, folks. In the state of California, who is going to fight this dynamic is a small number of people who care about this issue. It's not a massive civil rights movement, but it should be. So I want to analyze maybe how we could be a massive civil rights movement, and hopefully this isn't wishful thinking. If you look, why are homeless people being attacked? There's two faces of repression that I would say. One is gentrification, and one is criminalization. They work hand in glove with each other, and they give us a clue to how to build a broader movement. Gentrification is happening all over. I'm from the Bay Area, so I'll speak to San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, and Richmond. Gentrification means wealthy people coming into an area, buying up the housing that poor people used to dwell in, jacking up the rents, and then in their snotty, wealthy prejudice, asking the city council to give the bums rush to homeless people and to poor tenants of SRO hotels. We're seeing that happen all over in California. But say in Oakland, Jerry Brown comes into power, he has a 10K plan. That's to bring in 10K or 10,000 affluent residents into downtown Oakland. And the first thing he did to make that happen was to analyze all the single room occupancy hotels where poor people live and homeless people live when they get a foot off the street, and to look at a secret plan to eliminate every SRO hotel in downtown Oakland. I exposed that in Street Spirit after Jerry Brown's own mayoral aide, Justin Horner, called me on the phone and was panicked about what he was doing. I mean, he was talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to buy out the SRO hotels. We blew the whistle, Oakland activists blew the whistle, so Jerry Brown backed away from that, but that plan is still in force. When they want to bring the rich in, they got to demolish the SRO hotels, which is happening slowly in Oakland. And the other thing they do is start driving homeless shelters out of the area, which they're doing in Oakland. And they have the police crack down and do not racial profiling, but the same thing. It's ugly twin brother, economic profiling, to cleanse the area of homeless people. So that's happening in Oakland. Now, if you look at why that's happening in Oakland, it's because rents went so high in San Francisco, and the people started migrating to Oakland, and businesses migrated, and the rents went up there. Now what's happened is, if you know anything about Richmond, that has been a very poor community for many decades, but rents have now hit Richmond, so Richmond is gentrifying, rents are going sky high, and now, as a result, we have rich people in the Marina Bay neighborhood in Richmond wanting to sic the cops on homeless people, and those rich people own the City Council of Richmond. That's why the City Council voted 7-1 right before Christmas, and I said that they deserve the Ebenezer Scrooge Award for banning the homeless right before Christmas. But it was all driven by gentrification, and it's important for us to understand that. And I'll say why after just one more example. Santa Barbara, California, another affluent city, has had some of the best homeless activism of any city in California. I don't know if we know that. I mean, to me, that's ridiculous because it's this, my prejudice on Santa Barbara is this affluent coastal city, the most irrelevant tourist town in America. And yet, I swear to God, since the mid-1980s, they have been doing some of the most crusading, pioneering work to uphold the rights of homeless people. I don't get it myself, but One of the things that the activists will tell you in Santa Barbara is gentrification has wiped out 400 to 500 SRO hotel units. As homeless activists, we have to be as outraged about that as we are about sleeping bans. Because when they tore down the SROs in Santa Barbara and people ended up on the streets, that's exactly when you get this pressure of merchants and business owners and homeowners to criminalize homeless people. Now, we're going to see at the end of my little talk here how Santa Barbara has fought back. But I want to say one of the reasons this has been a good gathering for me is I get to meet activists face to face that have written for Street Spirit. Last month, I wrote two articles about Santa Barbara's fight back and its attempt to create legal RV parks, legal parks for vehicle dwellers, which I think is a real innovative solution. And I analyzed how Santa Barbara was doing it and all the cool kinds of activism they had and the fact that they have a public defender backing off the police from persecuting the homeless. And I really thought that's why Santa Barbara was going to get a legal RV park. But then I come here yesterday and I see there's another part of the picture, which is this. Santa Barbara homeless activists got wolves, folks. They're going to get an RV park because they're tooling around in RVs loaded to the brim with wolf packs. Now that. So when we're looking at how to strategize and build a homeless movement, you know, I could go on and on, but maybe what we need to do is get us some wolves. Another reason I think I'm on the right track is because when I was looking at Nancy McCready's wolves in her van, I noticed a woman coming up and kind of fearlessly petting him, and the damn wolf started chewing on her hand, and I said, hey, you know that's a wolf eating your hand, right? And she said, oh yeah, I'm from Dignity Village. We got wolf hybrids there. So see, you're seeing a thread here. We need wolves. All right, so when we say that it's not just about homeless people being criminalized, it's about communities being gentrified, and this is an attack of the wealthy against the poor, then that gives us an indication of how we have to fight back. Yes, we have to protest sleeping bans, protest camping bans, protest criminalization of panhandlers and people sitting on sidewalks. We have to protest that as the worst kind of bigotry that is existing in this new millennium. It's the worst human rights abuse we are facing in America, folks. No other minority is being persecuted. We have to fight that in the way that you are all doing valiantly, many of you. But there's another thing we have to fight. We have to fight gentrification. We have to make common cause with tenant groups fighting the demolition of public housing by HUD in the HOPE 6 program. We have to join with anti-eviction tenant groups fighting to get a just cause for eviction. We have to fight with all those folks fighting for rent control and fighting to keep big business from dictating who lives in our community. That's the fight. And that also is a clue about how we build a bigger movement. And so let me get concrete here about what I mean. In Oakland, I was an activist there for like 12 years building a homeless movement. And we did just what Robert said. We sledgehammered open vacant buildings. We got permanent housing built. We got a huge multi-service center with 200 transitional housing units built. We called all that not the housing that Jack built, but the housing that protest built. All that housing built by protest. But what we didn't ever have in Oakland was any solidarity from non-homeless folks. The labor unions weren't there for us. The tenant groups, the peace groups, none of those folks were there with us. I saw the same thing recently in Albany. The cops had told Albany homeless people for years, go out and camp across the freeway by the racetrack. People put up a camp there. They were respectful for years. They left the community alone. And then some fucking yuppie environmentalists wanted to walk their dogs there. I'm a dog lover too, but I don't use my dog as an excuse to drive homeless people away. These assholes did. They got the cops of Albany to drive homeless people out of that encampment, to eradicate that encampment, and that encampment was torn down in a despicable act. Now, that happened in Albany, which, as you know, is basically larger Berkeley, all right? At the same exact week that the Albany encampment was being torn down, we had 10,000 people, myself included, marching on the streets to protect KPFA from Pacifica. It was great activism. They said it was the largest protest in Berkeley since the Vietnam War. But do you know what? Even though we went on KPFA talking about the Albany encampment being torn down, none of those 10,000 peace and justice folks came and made common cause with their brothers and sisters in the Albany encampment that were being driven out by the cops. And that is wrong. And I don't know how to say this politely. We need the guilt trip to peace and justice movement to start, but they say, bringing the war home, start bringing peace and justice movement home here, because we need those folks. We should be saying that to the anti-war people. But in looking at gentrification, we have obvious allies. We have the tenant groups, the people fighting evictions, we have the people working for affordable housing, and we can make allies with those groups. So I'm wrapping up here. Let's get back to Oakland and Concord, and this is the last thing I'll say. In Oakland, for years, we fought the homeless struggle with only homeless people. But since Jerry Brown came into power, I just feel this sense of liberation, because all the homeless groups joined with the tenant groups, with the affordable housing group called East Bay Housing Organizations. They joined with the Just Cause for Eviction People. And when we were protesting in front of Jerry Brown's City Hall last year, it was homeless people, it was tenant groups, it was affordable housing advocates, the kind of people we usually dismiss because they're so lame. They were there. They were protesting Jerry Brown. Shelter providers were denouncing Jerry Brown with the hottest rhetoric I'd ever heard. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like utopia coming. And we were against Jerry Brown and the reactionary city council, and it just gave me a picture of where this movement could go. When the middle class and lower middle class and working class realizing they're in the same boat as us, they're being screwed. They're being priced out of housing. And let's not forget labor unions. One thing labor unions have always been aware of that most of us haven't is this thing called the take back, where employers, you know, give you something with one hand, then they take it back. So they take back your medical benefits, or they take back some wages, or they take back your right to organize, or take back vacation benefits. Unions know how to fight the take back. Well, what they don't know how to fight is the most massive take back against working people we've seen, and that's skyrocketing rents. That is taking back all the wages labor unions fought for. It's taking back the security of middle class people. And in the bigger cities, and now even in places like Richmond, people are aware that their rents are becoming unaffordable. They are aware that we are, you know, a couple paychecks or rent payments away from being homeless, and we have to find those people and make common cause. In Oakland, that's happening. In San Francisco, there's folks from San Francisco here. That's happening so well. Homeless advocates are totally allied with anti-eviction activists. They're allied with people fighting the demolition of the public housing in San Francisco, and they're allied with the folks from the mission activists in the MAC coalition that are fighting eviction and displacement and yuppies moving into the mission. The final place I want to share with you is Concord. This is my conclusion. Concord, to me, shows the future. On December 11th, the worst anti-camping law imaginable is enacted. Richmond. In Richmond, the worst anti-camping law is enacted. Within 2 weeks, they had formed a new coalition in a city, Richmond, which has virtually never had any good homeless activism. They had formed a coalition called the Homelessness is Not a Crime Coalition. And it was a small group of people, just like we're used to working in small groups. All they did is created a banner that said homelessness is not a crime. Since December, they have been at every single meeting of their city council, denouncing the city council for doing this. Their analysis is this progressive city council thought it could attack the homeless, curry favor with the landowners and the homeowners, get campaign contributions, and nobody would call them on it. So they want to make Richmond a pariah around the country and say that this progressive city has gone way wrong on us. So every city council meeting, they're there. When the Olympic torch came to Richmond, they were there. When the NAACP held a freedom fund, they were there, and that was controversial, but they were saying, it's not right to persecute minorities. The NAACP has fought that, so we're going to be here. to remind these hypocrites on the city council to give lip service to the NAACP that they are right now discriminating in the worst traditions of this country. They were there when the Lucretia Edwards Park was had its groundbreaking. They're there. And the phrase that comes to mind is relentless perseverance. That's how someone described nonviolence, and that's what I want to hold out to folks. That's what we have. That's what they can't take away from us, is relentless perseverance. They haven't taken it away from Robert Norris, who's been wearing that ratty damn bathrobe for like 15 years now that I've known. Robert Norris, I swear to God, is the smartest journalist Street Spirit has, and he's also the most marginalized guy in Santa Cruz. And I keep saying, Robert, make some friends and allies and quit alienating them. Stop doing that. And yet, the real lesson of Robert Norris is relentless perseverance. The guy will not back down, will not shut up, will prophetically challenge every anti-homeless thing, and every time something goes against homeless people, Robert's there. That's what I mean about relentless perseverance. I mean Dignity Village keeping going despite all its crises and all of its little melodramas, Dignity Village holding that ground. That's relentless perseverance. Now, in Richmond, relentless perseverance means a small group of activists is not just camping out somewhere. And this is so important. They are going into the halls of power and making people accountable. That is so important for us to know, that we don't just have to protest in some little corner that the system lets us dwell on, but we need to go to City Hall, and our tent cities, our encampments, whatever else they're doing, they had better be a staging ground for protest, or we're going to lose this one. So when I look at the future, I see two things. One, building a bigger movement. In Richmond, there's a small group of activists, but they have made common cause with Richmond Vision 2000, which is 60 labor unions, religious groups, neighborhood councils, and in the latest Street Spirits, which I didn't bring, I interview Reverend Phil Lawson, the chair of Richmond 2000. Now, Reverend Phil is an African-American pastor that got arrested with us at Oakland housing takeovers. He's now the chair of Richmond 2000, the hugest coalition in Richmond. He went to the city council with this little group of homeless activists and denounced the Richmond camping ban. So you can build those ties, and the religious community is a good way to start. And there's one final thing that they're doing right now in Richmond, which is they're also working on affordable housing. So that's my final word today, is when I look at Camp Paradise or Dignity Village or any of the places where there are very successful homeless encampments going, I want us to look long term and ask ourselves something. Is this the end of it? Is a campground where we raise our children in sleeping bags and tents all we're going to settle for? And don't get me wrong, I'm totally for creating homeless campgrounds. They make poverty visible, they confront the system, they give a legal and safe place to sleep to people that deserve it, and for some people, they're the best solution. But I want more than campgrounds. I want those campgrounds to be launching pads for housing takeovers, for common campaigns with tenants to fight back and get affordable housing back in this country so that our children can live in homes, not just a tent. Thank you. Thank you.